Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, June 15th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or listening through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever discovered in my over 47 years of doing therapy. These tools are gratefully available absolutely free due to the tireless efforts of Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the link in the upper left-hand corner of most pages that says Start Here, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. You can also download the actual worksheet itself, a PDF file. Click on it, download it, copy it, print it off, use it as often as you'd like. That tool is a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and relationships, manage my emotional states, and effectively turn any negative emotional state I have into part of the infallible guidance system that we've all been gifted. And if that sounds like anything that might be a benefit to you, it's available absolutely free at whyagain.org. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process. We also have discussions of a variety of other tools that Michael and Jeannie make available. And you can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains that worksheet process, an abbreviated version of that process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often. Go to the website, click download, read, try, use, because then you'll generate thoughts, comments, and questions, and we are here to entertain those 5 days a week, 2 hours a day in our current format. And if you have one of those questions, you can give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1. Alternatively, you can send us an email. You can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. And or you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. We've also made the commitment to go through the Course in Miracles lessons this year. And today is the 166th day of the year. And so these workbook lessons, one for each day, land us with the lesson that says, I am entrusted with the gifts of God. And the commentary for today's lesson is quite long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. It has a total of 15 paragraphs. But the essence of it is, all things are given you. The Creator's trust in you is limitless. Creator knows its offspring, and it gives without exception, holding nothing back that can contribute to your happiness. And yet, unless your will is one with the Creator's gifts are not received. But what would make you think there is something other than the Creator's will? Here is the paradox that underlies the making of the world that you see. The world that you see is not the will of the Creator, and so it is not real. Yet those who think it real must still believe there is another will and one that leads to opposite effects from those. So here's the idea. We've talked at great length about how science has been very, very clear at helping us understand that, contrary to what our culture teaches us, perception is not a passive thing. We are very actively, all day, every day, creating our own perception. We're creating the sights and the sounds that we hear and we see. We are creating the meanings of them. And literally no two people watching events unfold get exactly the same impression of those events, because each of us is creating our impression of life. And the world we see is not all that has been created by the Creator. So, the last paragraph of the commentary says, betray it not, become living proof of what the Christ mind's touch can offer everyone. The Creator has entrusted all these gifts to you, all its gifts to you. So be a witness by choosing happiness, choosing joy. Be a witness in your happiness to how transformed the mind becomes when it chooses to accept all of the creation's gifts and to feel the touch of the Christ mind. This is your mission now. For the Creator entrusts the giving of its gifts to all who have received them. It has shared its joy with you, and now you're free to go share it with the world. And Pam Grout, in her book, Course in Miracles Experiment, lesson 166, it's kind of the antithesis of the commentary, 15 paragraphs of commentary in the workbook lesson, and it's quite short, and she titles this lesson, Universe Dreams Bigger Than I Do for Myself, and she quotes Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, and other books. She quotes her as saying, where is the joy in my life, and what have I sacrificed it for? Pam writes, there are a grand total of two ways to do things. Whether I'm writing a blog post or having a conversation with my BFF, whether I'm making a smoothie or plans for a European vacation, I either use the resources of door number one or door number two. Door number one, the drug of choice for many, means using the power of my own resources, making decisions based on limited thoughts within my own head, with what I've learned from my parents, from school, from the news. To summarize, it means using resources of the past. Door number two, the only other choice, uses resources beyond my limited brain. Door number two encourages me to conduct my life in faith, accepting all gifts bestowed by my invisible inner source. In lesson 166, I am entrusted with the gifts of source. It says all gifts are given without exception, with nothing held back. Whether aware or not, these gifts are reliable, constant, and far superior to anything I can conceive. I can deny their presence. I can depend on the limited resources of door number one. Or I can jump in face first, knowing Source intends only joy. So that's our lesson for today, a very limited review of the commentary in the Course in Miracles workbook and the very short summary from Course in Miracles experiment. We are asked to stop relying on the world we see. We are asked, as Einstein would have us come to pay attention to, we've been given a precious gift, which is the intuitive mind, the connection to Source, the Christ mind, etc., whatever you want to call it. And we've been given a faithful servant, which is the conscious logical mind. And the problem that we run into most often, whatever the problem is, its root cause is the fact that we live in a culture that's taught us to forget the precious gift and elevate what is supposed to be a faithful servant to the level of master. So most of us can honestly say that we were not raised in school or in our homes being taught about how to be intuitive, how to do exercises to develop our intuitive capacities, to get quiet and turn within and ask to be shown. Whatever the question is in the moment. And this lesson from Course in Miracles is trying to get us to wake up to that. And, it says, if you have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, it says, the world that you see is not creator created. How can you say that? Well, because your eyes only see a very limited amount of the light spectrum. We call it the visible spectrum.
Right.
But what's visible about it? To whom is it visible? Why do we have to use the word visible? Because the spectrum of energy that we call light is far broader than what our eyes as antennas can register and interpret. So we don't even, just take one thing. We don't even see everything there is to be seen, even when our eyes are wide open and we're not being blocked by any kind of emotional disturbance. We just don't physically have the capability to see what's there, what we're swimming in. We don't see ultraviolet. We don't see infrared. We don't see the X-rays and microwaves and other energies that we're swimming in. We don't see Indra's web. We don't see the Planck's constant energy that connects all things. So that's just on one level, just one level of our senses. We don't hear everything that is there. Whales communicate, elephants communicate, dogs hear things that we don't hear. It just doesn't register in our antenna called the ear. It goes on. Here we have people that are been affected by one of the recent viruses, and they lose their sense of smell and their sense of hearing. But we already know that dogs and wolves and all kinds of other animals register things in their olfactory senses that we don't register at all. So, this isn't pie in the sky philosophical woo-woo stuff when the Course in Miracles says the world you see is not the world that the Creator created. we're only seeing a tiny bit of it. And then we have people like Anil Seth and other people who are studying perception, and we realize that not only do we only register a tiny bit of what's there to be registered in terms of the physical energies, but we are making up in our brain our best guess of what is actually out there based on our past history and our emotions and traumas and hopes and fears and intellectual capacities, but basically from our past experiences. And every one of us is, quote, hallucinating whatever sights or sounds and the attendant meanings of those sights and sounds that register in our brains. That maybe 20% of what goes into the input that goes into what any image I see is coming from the light waves that stimulate the optic nerve. And then 80% of it is coming from my past experiences and my belief system and my trauma structures. So we are taught to think of ourselves as physical and nothing else. I was doing some work reading a book. I'm not yet ready to recommend the book, but in one of the sections, it's talking about, let's try to understand the relationship between body and mind, and consequently the meaning of the body's ills in relation to the soul's bruises. To do that, we must enlarge the view we have of the human being and life itself. If we remain stuck in the materialistic concept of man as machine, with its notion of the body as a series of independent, interchangeable parts, much like a car, then the subtle energy connections that I'm about to outline here are going to seem like magical thinking. Yet this is precisely the point, that the physical manifestations and symptoms of illness that we experience point to something deeper that lies within us. A simple mechanical observation cannot reveal the true source of pain and illness because its view is too much glued to the symptoms. The field of observation is limited in terms of both time and space, and this prevents us from going to the real cause of our problems, which the mechanistic view explains in terms of fate, in case of accidents, or interaction with external elements in the form of viruses or microbes or food or the environment. So by expanding our view and observing the human being as a whole, both physically and temporally, we can begin to connect the dots, so to speak. This is what religion, from the Latin religare, meaning to connect or to link, was intended to do by assigning to humans a real dimension that is first and foremost spiritual. By taking this approach, we can begin to understand humanity's mission and consequently the reasons for dis-ease. So if we stay in the mechanistic view, you know, one of the things that is I've seen this in a number of different sources, and people talk about how, you know, if our current medical model is true and we are just physical, then we ought to be able to, for example, this is easier to visualize than a human, in a human, we ought to be able to take off somebody's arms and take off their legs and take out their liver and take out their kidney and take out their heart and their lungs and take out their brain and just set them aside and then reassemble them and the person get up and walk away. And we know that doesn't work. Now medical science keeps saying, yes, we get closer because now we can take the heart out and keep it hooked up to machines and keep it beating and then, you know, put somebody else's heart in, blah, blah, blah. The fact of the matter is there are serious limits to the mechanistic, materialistic view of the human. And Evan Alexander is one who studied the brain, and he studied neurology, and he studied, and he was convinced by the current mode of science that consciousness is simply the byproduct of random neural firings, that there's nothing to us except the physical. And then he had a medical situation develop in which his brain was encased in pus and infection, and everything that we can register with our physical machines and scans, and it was telling all the experts his brain is dead. And they were keeping him alive on life support, and they had him in a coma, and they were pumping all of these antibiotics in. And after days, they finally said to his family, well, you know, we could keep giving him this stuff, but even if he comes back now, his brain has been offline for so long that he'll just be a vegetable. He'll never have any intellectual capacity because that whole part of his brain has been dead and encased in infection and been, you know, damaged. And the end of the story is that he did come back. And he did have, and after 7 or 8 days, whatever it was, an extraordinary story to tell, which included awareness that nothing in the physical realm can account for. Awareness of things that happened in his own personal experience, whether you want to call it spiritual or not. Awareness of things that was happening physically around him in the hospital, even outside of the room that his body was lying in. Conversations that took place, people that visited, that he could have no logical way to have access to if you believed that we're nothing but the physical. So the idea is hard science demonstrates to us that we are not just physical beings, and yet most of us rely almost exclusively on a medical model that only accounts for our physicality. And then we wonder why things go wrong. So there's a story that I was relaying a week or two or three ago of a gentleman who was in the sports field, and he progressed to the point where he moved to Florida to become the president of the Florida hockey team, professional hockey team. And then when he got there and started the job, it wasn't long before he had this health crisis, and he couldn't function, and he couldn't sleep, and he couldn't concentrate, and all these things were going wrong. And they did every, because he had lots of money, he was, you know, high up in our society in terms of financial accomplishments, et cetera. And he had this high-paying job as president of this big-money hockey league team, and they couldn't find anything. They did all the tests they could, and finally they said, okay, here's the problem. This is only emotional. So he eventually ended up in the office of a psychiatrist, and if I remember the story correctly, after his first visit with a psychiatrist, he left with 5 medications. After, I believe it was a period of 3 years, he had been to one doctor after another, and been through, I think they said, 50 different medications they had tried him on, and they finally said to him, your last-ditch effort, the last possible chance we have to help you is transcranial magnetic stimulation, very powerful magnets close to the brain to stimulate, and if that doesn't work, then convulsive shock therapy, electroshock therapy, which they don't really call it convulsive shock therapy anymore because they've tempered it with computers. It used to be that they would shock people with car batteries and other strong electrical devices, and their bodies would go into convulsions so strong that they would actually snap, bones would break. So they learned to give them, you know, tranquilizers and put their body to sleep first, and muscle relaxers and things, and then they would shock the body. And but it's much more subtle, but it's still, they were telling him that his last hope was to have electrical, strong electrical stimulations run through his brain. And if that didn't work, that it, he's a hopeless case. It wasn't until after all of that happened that he ended up in the office of an integrative therapist. And the therapist was the first person that said to him, I'd like to teach you to breathe differently and relax your body, and I'd like to ask you what's been going on in your life. What are the stresses in your life? No one, according to his report, all those medications were given, all those medical tests were given, and nobody asked him, what's been going on in your life? What are your stresses? What are your hopes and fears? What are your biggest traumas? How was your life growing up? What are you feeling about pressure on yourself to succeed or feeling yourself as a failure or whatever? Not once, according to his report, had anybody asked him about any of those issues until after they exhausted everything they could think of physically in the test realm and every medication they have for psychotropic psychiatric problems. And this woman said, well, here's this three-day breathing technique training I want you to go to. It was so powerful and effective for him, I believe that he said he stayed with it for 30 days. And then he got introduced to another integrative treatment specialist. And he got his life back. And he got his life back so fully that he decided he was going to make a difference. And he created SameHereGlobal.org. What saved him, what brought his life back, was thinking about his mental and emotional energy and dynamics, his spirituality, not just thinking of his body as a car he's driving around in, as a physical device. And so that's what we're after in this work, to understand that I can't keep operating from core negative beliefs, faulty cause and effect relationships, the false cause and effect relationships that my culture teaches me. You made me angry. You hurt my feelings. That's a natural disaster. There is no such thing as a natural disaster. There's just the movement of nature. And then we as humans label it good or bad. Oh, isn't that a great torrential rain? Isn't that a godsend that it's finally raining here in Illinois, where we're having the longest drought, the biggest drought we've had since 2012? And then if we get a big rainfall, we say, oh, isn't that magnificent? No, it's just rain. Isn't this drought horrible? No, it's just a drought. It doesn't become good or bad, right or wrong, up or down, until a human mind judges it. So, you know, the idea of understanding that when I judge something as bad, that creates a tension in me, and that literally creates the impact on me, not the outside event, but my interpretation of it. If I don't learn the truth of that, the capital T truth, of how I'm creating my experience of life in each new present moment with the focus I choose for my conscious awareness, then I am, as Michael Rice would say, unconsciously creating. Because whatever I focus my attention on, I'm going to get more of. Whatever interpretations I place on life events, that's the impact it's going to have on me. Neutral, good, bad, or somewhere in the middle. If I am not taught this, I am actively participating in something without my awareness, and I'm creating consequences that I'm unaware of, and then I attribute cause and effect relationships most often to correlational relationships. If two or more things happen in close proximity to each other in terms of my ability to perceive time, then I'm likely to assign a cause and effect relationship independent of whether or not there's any cause and effect relationship happening. Other cause and effect relationships that I operate from might be taught to me by my religion. They might be taught to me by my parents, my family belief system. They might be taught to me by the prejudice in the town or the family that I was brought up in. Oh, that just happened because that person's skin is this color. Oh, of course that would happen because that person's from this side of the tracks. The prejudging. I had somebody do this the other day. Somebody was describing a neighbor they have, and the neighbor has three lots, and they would like to buy one of those lots. And they were describing that neighbor, and they said, well, at the end of the three lots closest to my lot, they put a burn pile. And what I would like to do is to buy that first lot that's right next to me. And then there's another lot, they may only want to sell the two. And this is a person who's got, you know, the lot he's on, he's got trucks and motorcycles, and he's got a big dump truck that he uses, and he's probably got eight different motorcycles. And someone else who was listening to this conversation said, oh, I wonder who he voted for. And there's that prejudgment. There is that absolute. There's another wonderful example of what this person's assuming is a cause and effect relationship that isn't there. I personally know some people who have lots of motorcycles and trucks, and they don't instantly fall into a Republican mindset. If we are not taught about how we create false, arbitrary cause and effect relationships, if we are not taught about how our choice of interpretation of life events is the very thing that creates the impact upon us, then we do not have the capacity to change it. So that's my thoughts for today, and we have somebody with a hand up and a switchboard that's not responding quickly, but I believe this is Ellen.
Yes, it is. Hi, Dr. Tim.
Hello, Ellen. How can we support you today?
Well, actually, I just wanted to chime in with you because what you were talking about is exactly like a deeper realization I had the other morning over the weekend. And it kind of started with, and it's really just like a deeper understanding of equality. And it kind of started with me when I was reading Byron Katie's book, A Thousand Names for Joy, and in one of her stories, she was talking about how due to her eye condition, she wasn't seeing very well, and therefore it was much easier for her to, you know, trip over things and fall down. And she wrote that, you know, in her life, in her view, that falling down is equal to not falling down, and that getting up after falling down is equal to not being able to get up. And when I read that, I thought, wow, that just, it sounded so radical. But yet, I saw how, well, gee, if those things are equal, if everything, if every experience is equal, no matter what the outcome is, then how would you ever get pulled out of peace? And so I could see how, yes, I mean, if that is the way that she's living her life, everything is joy. So it kind of started with that, and then I heard was listening to an interview with Brother
Jacobson. Let me just interrupt. Let me just, before you leave that point, let me just interrupt and do what my brain, I'll share out loud what my brain just did. If you live your life that way, it doesn't mean everything is joy. This is just what my brain did. What it means is everything is neutral and you're free to choose joy or anger or bitterness or resentment, etc.
Sure. Yep. That's
and
it.
I don't,
it's,
I'm
it's
just
choosing.
I'm just sharing that's what my brain did. Said, no, wait, not everything is joy in this woman's life, and she doesn't even pretend that, right? But she's clearer and clearer the more she works at it. Of course, she had one of those shocking deep revelations. She woke up and everything had changed for her. But I think the message, especially for those of us who haven't had that, is to wake up and realize not that everything is joy, but everything is neutral, and we get to choose the joyful response, the bitter hurt response, the judgmental response, and that's what's going to create our experience of life. Hold on to your second point before you make it. I was just also thinking last night. I got home after a long day of work, and I went to get some I had a container of whatever they call that, fried rice. And I'm tired. It's a long day at work. I open the refrigerator, and I open it to make sure that, you know, it's what I think it is, and the whole container drops out of my hand and spills on the floor. And I just started laughing, just good-natured laughing. You know, I have this set of hands that work a certain way, and here it is, I'm tired. And I just, so 5 or 10 years ago, or 15 or 20 certainly, what would have erupted out of me would have been swear words and red-faced and, upset. And last night, what erupted out of me, there was no effort intended. It just erupted out of me, just laughter.
Yeah.
And the end result is the same either way, right? I still have to do something to clean up the stuff on the floor. I'm either going to be able to eat the stuff that didn't fall out of the container or have to throw it all away, whatever. That doesn't change anything. But in the moment, I have the choice, once I am, alerted to this, and I've had a lot of times over the years since learning Michael's work probably 17 or 18 years ago, where I've been triggered and had to do some EFT tapping and breathing and goal canceling and find out, what's this negative belief I'm holding about myself and dismantle it before I got to the point where when I drop the food I want to eat at the end of a long day, I erupt in laughter instead of rage. But the point is still there. It's an option.
Mm-hmm.
The event of the food dropping to the floor didn't cause the rage in me before, and it's not causing the laughter in me now. It's the interpretation I place on it. It's the understanding of the flow. So that was the point I wanted to make. What was your second point?
Yes, and I agree. So I was sitting with that and thinking, wow, like if I could really embrace everything that appears to be a bad experience, and see it that it's equal to the opposite experience. And so anyway, I had been sitting with that for a while, and then I heard Leonard Jacobson say, it must have been Saturday because it was Sunday morning that all this started like deepening in me. I heard him say that in order to transcend the world of duality, you have to bring it into perfect balance. Everything is equal. And so that really struck a chord with me because I had been thinking about this concept of equality and hadn't really related it to a state of perfect balance. But then he said that, and it was like, oh, yeah. And I just saw how, like exactly what you just said, like the situation itself, and this relates to not only every person and everything, of course, being equal, but every experience. Whenever I think about these things, I always notice these principles that whether you're in, like, you know, actuality or whether you're in duality, the world of illusions, the same principles hold. The same principles hold. So I was looking at this principle of equality. And, of course, you know, in a state of unity, there's perfect equality. But also that exists in the world of illusions. But we can choose to not see that. And that's the only time we suffer. We can choose to say, no, this is better or worse than that. And it's like, if it's a world of illusions, how can one illusion be better or worse than another illusion? I mean, it seems crazy, like, that I didn't get this before.
Right, but the absolute essence of it is that there is no difference, and yet I create the impact on me and the experience of it as either good or bad, right or wrong, as I choose my interpretation of it.
Right. So I had had, because what really struck me, you know, what I just, like, got and I wrote down was everything is equal. This includes life and death. Because I'd had the experience of a few days before that, where I had these little, whenever I pull a head of romaine out of my garden, I always like to soak it in the sink, and usually, like, little earwigs crawl out of it, and I stand there and wait for them and rescue them. But sometimes, you know, I find some in the bowl afterwards, and they're just laying there lifeless. And anyway, so that, you know, that happened, but I was, like, I was busy, too busy to, like, drain the sink and clean it out, so I, like, left it for a while. Came back about an hour later, and I was like, okay, I'm going to pull out these little bodies, scoop them out before I drain the water. And the first one I scooped out immediately came to life. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, he was in there for, like, an hour and a half. But, like, I thought, like, I felt so happy. But I thought at the time that that's why I was so happy. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe the other ones will come to life, too. So I went to scoop the other ones out, and they did not, right? So that's what really struck me, is, like, those, what I really got was those outcomes were equal. There is no death. There is no death. And so, but only if I believe that in life and death, and that life is better than death, because in this world, life and death are equal. I mean, what we call life can't compare to actual life. I mean, it's like, you know, like, all these things that we think are so good, right? Love, like, love in this world isn't actual love. Freedom in this world isn't actual love. We think, oh, well, it's better to be free than to be in prison. But we are in prison. I mean, it's like, you know, we're in the prison of our minds, of our thinking. So it's like, to think that, oh, God, I just got it in such a big way that, no, that little earwig coming to life isn't what made me happy, and the ones that didn't come to life didn't make me unhappy. It was my choosing to see it that way. And
well, and that's the point. Right? That's the point we're going for with all of this work. And if that weren't the case, then there would be no power in the reality management worksheet. There would be no benefit to pulling out of a reality management worksheet when I feel a negative emotional state. I would, it would be effort. It would be pointless, right? If I was not mm-hmm. the one creating my experience of life, then changing my awareness of my thought process, canceling a goal, asking to be shown something else would be pointless. Because if the truth of it is, when a strong wind takes down a tree on my property, that's a tragedy, then nothing about doing a reality management worksheet or changing my perspective on it would have any impact on my life. It would be simply the outside event having the impact. So that's it. You're there, and at one level you're observing at a deeper level of truth the actual mechanism that gives any power to the reality management worksheet and the other tools that Dr. Michael Jeanne Rice offer at whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And they're there absolutely free. Free for download.
Oh, go ahead.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So right after I had all these wonderful realizations, I went downstairs and I saw a big pile of vomit on the rug. And I just watched how my mind wanted to say, oh, now you got to clean that up. And then the next thought was, oh, I wonder if one of the cats is sick. You know, and I looked at that and I said, wow. And I knew that this situation, this pile of vomit on the rug, is absolutely meaningless. And here is my mind trying to put meaning onto it, meaning that would pull me out of peace. And it's like, no way, no way. And I would not allow that. And, you know, I just saw the deception in how my mind just wants to interpret, you know, and it was easy in that moment because I just had all that realization how everything is equal and it's me choosing. That's how I was, interpreting, The Course in Miracles talking about seeing through the eyes of Christ. I choose how I want to look on something. I choose that. And if I choose that everything is good, every experience is a good experience, because that's how it actually is. Only in the world of illusions can something appear to be good or bad. So knowing
And in this realm, what we're being called to do with the Course in Miracles lessons and the Michael Rice work is to catch ourselves when we're making those judgments and cancel them. And asking to be shown how to look at it, how to interpret it, how to be a blessing in that moment, these various ways. How do I respond without the judgment that labels one thing good and another bad? That opens up an extraordinarily vast, beyond words, potential for living that many people who step into the use of these tools are finding.
Yeah, it's like that door number two that when you read the Pam Grout.
Pam Grout talks about, yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And, you know, so I just chose to see it as totally meaningless and there's no cause for concern, number one, that one of my cats is ill. There's no cause for concern. There's no cause for me to be upset because now I have to clean this up. There's absolutely no cause for that at all unless I choose to create it in my own mind. So, and it really opened my eyes to, how I judge everything. When I thought of judgment, I thought of judging myself or judging other people. I wasn't recognizing how I was judging every happening, and putting that judgment on it. And then after all that, then I read my lesson for the day, and it was talking about writing the balance and we will not judge today. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is just tying right in with everything I just experienced, you know? So, and then you started talking about it today. So I was like, okay, I gotta put my 2 cents worth in there because yeah, I really, it changes everything.
Yeah. And it keeps changing so that we don't have to be, you know, what's the most common word we have thrown around? We don't have to be a victim of it. We get to realize that there's an entirely, and most people have never even questioned this. Most people have never even been brought to this level of awareness where you can question, is there a benefit or a negative cost to me when I judge things? What would it be like if I went through my life and I refused to judge? Now, this is different from discerning, right? So the discerning lets me understand that there's a difference between a clean carpet and a carpet with vomit on it. So it's not like I ignore the vomit. It's not like I ignore
right.
the food that I spilled on the floor. I don't ignore it, but there's a difference between having the ability to see it and perceive it and judging it as good or bad, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I'm glad you called with your input, and I wonder if there's something else, another aspect of it, or another comment or question you have for us today.
I don't think so. That was it. I just, you know, hearing you talk about the exact thing that I was really recognizing was, again, you know, it's just another alignment, you know, that seems to happen more and more and more.
The use of these tools opens up that level of perception. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I start to see things and potentials for things that I never saw before. When I learn to question instead of, operating from my past or insisting on answers, as Rilke would call us to, learning to live in the question rather than demanding the answer. When I get into that habit pattern, life changes fairly dramatically. And learning to live in the question is an extraordinarily powerful difference from demanding answers or trying to know everything or thinking I know something when, you know, basically my senses are only picking up a fraction of the physical realm that's there. Somebody that we know put a hand up here in our last 7 minutes. Susan, is that you?
It is. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Susan.
Good talk, everybody. You know, Dr. Tim, I listened and I could only listen to half because your show started and I didn't want to miss it, to your newest podcast with Diedrich Wolzak. And it is so good, even though I'm only halfway through. It's so good, and it fits with all you've been talking about especially about how he takes full responsibility, which you're talking about, full responsibility for his experience, even to the point where you and he sort of took a fork in the road and then you came around, where you said, I wonder if we could say, though, that the Holocaust wasn't chosen by this person, but their reaction to it is a choice. And he said, I agree with you totally, but ultimately it's the whole shebang. We actually dreamed that dream, including that's our creation. And the idea, he said, this depth of knowledge of our responsibility is very freeing. I'm not there yet, but I love that he said that. And then hitching that to yesterday's lesson, where I've paraphrased, my mind affirms a thought of God rather than let my mind deny the thought of God. My mind affirms the thought of God, and it says you don't have to be certain. You just have to accept and desire, or I put it in the other order, desire and accept the truth of this, which I thought was talk about a freeing thought. Just desire and accept it and let the work be done somehow despite reservations or doubts or whatever, you know, I feel as if I'm a person with one foot on one side of a fence and one foot on the other. It sounds as if Ellen's feet are all on one side for the most part, and I want to come over there. But anyway,
well, remember,
Ellen,
remember
this,
as it, when
yeah.
it sounds like that to you, Susan, remember that's in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not, and like when I dropped the food last night, it's not like nothing happens in my life gets an angry response anymore. It's not like every time I stub a toe or, you know, things don't go the way I want that I just chuckle and laugh it off. But in the moments
yeah.
where things are flowing, that's a possibility. Mm. And
yeah.
having exposure to that moment where my eyes are open and I'm not rushing to judgment, I've developed the thought pattern of questioning and mm. laughing at life and myself. When that pattern takes over, it demonstrates to me that the outside event isn't causing the response. But
right.
it's not.
Right.
It's not that everyone all the time responds, or anybody all the time responds in that way. I think I was telling the story
right.
about Dr. Gabor Mate, and he was he'd been with Diedrich Wolzak, and he'd, you know, had his course, and he'd done that work. And days after that, he was flying back home, and his wife was supposed to pick him up at the airport, and she didn't pick him up. And the end result was Dr. Mate pouted for 3 days with his wife of, you know, 30, 40-some years. And here's a very bright guy, and he's studied some of the best philosophical and psychological techniques ever. But putting them into practice in his life moment to moment is still a challenge.
Yeah.
So I caution you against
that
putting people on the pedestal like that. Go ahead.
Well, Diedrich Wolzak, earlier in the talk, and I want to go back and hear it unless you remember it too, he said something like that. He said, I'm still challenged, or I'm not there all the time. Do you remember what he said? It was very early on, and I didn't go back to listen.
Well, it's essentially the same message. We should
yeah,
mention for
exactly.
people before we completely run out of time that what you're talking about is a podcast that's available absolutely free. It's at journeysdream.org/podcast, and it's available. It's the On Your Mind podcast with Journey's Dream. And Diedrich Wolzak
so
was kind enough to let us interview him for that.
Really good. I copied the link, Ellen, and I'm going to send it to our Zoom group, anybody who wants to listen before tomorrow or at any time. I think it's just so delicious.
I just started listening to a talk of his that's on his website.
Mm-hmm.
Explains his whole process. I haven't gotten very
yeah.
far into it, but I'm finding that quite good as well.
Right.
And we present it here because it's essentially exactly
the same
process
yeah.
as the reality
right.
management worksheet that's available absolutely free at yagain.org. And you know, hours of shows, special shows curated by Jeannie Rice that will help you step through the use of the reality management worksheet. And and if you go to mindshiftersacademy.org on the educational materials page, there's a forgiveness worksheet patter that if you add the regular worksheet and that forgiveness patter, you get almost exactly Diedrich Wolzak's six-step choose again forgiveness process. It is,
yeah.
and it's not a coincidence because both Dr. Michael Rice and Diedrich Wolzak studied and learned and practiced what was taught in the Course in Miracles, and that's what's informing both of these pieces of work.
Mm, so exciting.
Yeah, and he mentioned someone else in the beginning of that video that he learned from, and he said that person actually took A Course in Miracles and put it into more of a layman's terms, but I don't remember that person's name. And this was like 40 years ago, he said. Anyway.
Well, thank you both for your comments, calls, and questions. I will mute you so we can do our shift change, as it were. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Have a great show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, June the 15th, 2021, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And hopefully by the end of today, the Android app will be up and running. The iPhone is already out there. So just keep holding the space that all that works out. And I am doing the show today. Michael's actually breathing and processing and instead of playing a repeat show. Susan and I had some email correspondence. Susan, I'm going to turn your microphone back on. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do the show today, and we're going to talk about this. So it's
can't wait.
take a deep breath. So it's on obsessive compulsive disorder, and you know it's often referred to as a mental illness, but it doesn't have to be. And I am OCD, and we've actually changed that to OCB because it's an obsessive compulsive blessing instead of a disorder. So changing the way you think about it, and so. Susan had written to me and was surprised that we admitted that I was OCD. And, you know, it's just an example, and it's part of, like, needing to do it right. And I sat after my email and after Aria went down for her nap and started taking notes of what I needed to cover for this. So,
whoa.
So do you want me to just start talking, or do you want to start with a question, or how do you want to do this?
Well, if you have a starting point that you thought of, go ahead. I mean, I'm looking forward to this so much. So.
Okay. Well, some of the things when I did some research on, you know, okay, what's going on with me? This is some time back. You know, usually OCD usually begins with some kind of fear. And then it becomes an obsession to attempt to protect yourself from that fear. And it's, you know, some of the common ones you hear about are people repeatedly washing their hands, you know, because they're worried about germs, or continually going back and checking to see that the door was locked. I will go back and double check the oven or the stove. And sometimes that may not be so obvious to the other people, you know, in the house, whether it's Michael or Dad or whoever, but I will check the stove and the oven a couple of times before I leave the kitchen to make sure that I've turned it off. Even though I know really that I have turned it off, I still double check. It's like I'm questioning myself. Some people even have like body tics or constantly clearing their throat or repeating words or whatever. I had never thought about it, but when I was looking it up, they said that hoarding is actually a sign of OCD. And my mom was like a number one hoarder. I mean, after she passed away and I came to the house to, you know, help Dad get some things settled and all, and that was before he got sick. It was like so many things. And after looking back at it, what her fear was, you know, she was raised up in the Depression, and like, you know, I remember her telling things like, you know, the only time that they ever got chewing gum was at Christmas, or the only time they got fruit was at Christmas. And I think that her hoarding came from the fear of not having. And, I mean, she was even to the point of, like, if we went to a restaurant, she saved the straw and the napkins and brought them home. And, I mean, I never realized that was OCD. Mm-hmm. And I just figured, you know, that she just had some kind of a fear and needed to hang on to everything. But another symptom of it, if you want to call it a symptom, is needing to stay on task and to do things to perfection, and that's me. And I have to totally clear my to-do list. It's like I go through my email and I will get rid of the junk email first, just get it out of the way so it's not cluttering my inbox. And then when I get time, I go back and I actually go through and respond to emails and answer. But my inbox and my email hardly ever goes more than 2 days without being cleaned out. I mean, that's like, I can't stand having all these piled up emails or whatever. And it's the same in the house. You know, it's like needing things to be neat and put back in place. You know, if you go to shut a cabinet or a drawer and it doesn't totally shut all the way and it's hanging open by an inch or something, I'll go through and I'll close it. And one of the things that I know it triggers Michael sometimes is he'll be working on something and I'm going right behind him and I'm, you know, picking up the trash and throwing it away immediately, or I'm picking up papers or I'm putting things back up. And then within just a minute, maybe he's like, where is this or that? You know, I still needed it. And it's like, oh, I've already put it up. So I have to go get it and bring it back. But it's the need to have things put back up. And one of the big aha moments for me was I was doing a worksheet on clutter. I mean, it's just the clutter triggers all kinds of emotions in me. And in doing the worksheet, you know, if you're familiar with the worksheet, and the top, you know, once you've identified, you know, what's going on and who it is and the situation, then you put down, there's a little block there where you can draw. And then at the bottom, there's another one. Now, that may be on the older one, but I was doing a worksheet, and when I went over to draw in that little box, I drew a stick figure, which was me. And then I drew boxes and piles of paper and all of these things. They were all different colors and all different shapes, and they were just piled up. And by the time I got the box filled up with all this stuff, you couldn't see the stick figure. And so my big aha was that, you know, clutter meant there wasn't room for me. There wasn't space for me. I wasn't important. You couldn't see me. Other stuff was more important to have around than to have me, and I needed space. And I think part of that also came from, you know, there were seven of us lived in a three-bedroom house all my life. And then with Mom being a hoarder, I mean, it was like there just wasn't space. And I never had my own space. I never had my own room. And it's like, and I just needed to breathe. And so then that came out that, you know, okay, if it was cluttered, I couldn't breathe. And so I think all the fears of some of that, you know, stayed. And it's like, okay, I just need to, if I can control the outside clutter, then I don't have to pay attention to the internal chaos. And it was the thoughts and the feelings of that I wasn't. Woo, it brought up emotion.
So I'm right here,
Jeannie. Thank you. So I know that it's an internal thing, but I still, it's uncontrollable to need to have space. And then when we moved in here to take care of Dad, I cleared away a lot of Mom's clutter, but for Dad's sake, I left a lot. And then we moved in with all of our stuff, and it's still, like I said, it's like an 1,800 square foot, three-bedroom house. It's like small.
And
so
it's
there's
the same
still no
house.
Room. It's the same
it's
house.
The same house. Yeah.
And a lot of the same clutter. And then we add our own to it. And then we have the baby. She takes up the living room. And, you know, all that stuff is good. But it doesn't. You know, OCD is not something you can just say, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to worry about that.
That's it.
There are things you can do to help it. You know, one of the big things, which Michael has to make me do because I won't do it, is to stop and do self-care, you know, soak in a bathtub or go get a massage or whatever. And
right,
I'm getting better at that. I attempt to, after the radio show, if Ari is still asleep, I'll go in and do an Avacyn, you know, put my hand in the Avacyn, and that usually puts me to sleep, so I'll take a 30-minute nap, and it's kind of a refresher. Another thing that I do, and I'm just, this is just open confession here to the world, is that because I need to get tasks done and things off my to-do list, I do have the ability to have great attention to details. And that has mm-hmm. paid off, you know, even things like doing the app or doing the website or whatever, proofreading documents for Michael or whatever, it helps to do that. So it has been a blessing. It also paid off when I was in the workforce, and I worked for a pharmaceutical company, and one time we had these big issues come up about one of the drugs. And my boss knew that I had the ability to basically sit. I didn't do shorthand, but I did speed writing. And I could sit in a conversation and catch almost every word that everybody said. Mm-hmm. And because I could do that, when they had these big conferences on this drug and the issues that were going on with it, they had me come in and take notes of the, now why they didn't just record it, I don't know, but take notes of what was discussed and who said what and what they decided to do and all of that. And it actually pushed me into like a promotional type position. And that whole group, and I mean, it was, they were scientists and researchers, and like, you know, here I'm this little peon, I'm a tech assistant in the lab. And, but because I could pay attention to detail and capture what everybody was saying, I actually got to go to London like 3 times. That was where our main headquarters was. And they were so good with me. I mean, like they flew me first class with the researchers and everything else, you know, and I would sit in the meetings and take notes, and that's all I did. So actually that ended up being a blessing, that I did pay so much attention to details. But because I have to get things done, it pushes me sometimes to the limit of, you know, physical exhaustion, that I need to finish this, I need to complete this task. But then it also does another thing, is that if I know that, say, Michael has to do something and he might have 2 weeks to get it done, I'll remind him every day, and I know that drives him crazy or brings up his crazy. I'll remind him, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, you know, but it's like it's on my to-do list even though it's on his. And it's like, you know, I just need to get that done and get it out of the way. A lack of control, and I'm sure that a lot of mine has come from, you know, when I couldn't take it living here in the clutter and everything and didn't have my own space, and it's like I just wanted to get out. And leaving is one of my big issues. Michael's actually, I had to take it off the table because, I mean, it's still one of the things when I get to the depression stage, which comes with OCD, or if I go into the overwhelm stage, then leaving is my first, I got to get out of here, you know. And I know that I take it with me, that you can't run from it.
Right.
But it's so needing to control my environment so that I feel safe, I guess. Go ahead.
I was thinking your little stick figure surrounded with boxes. It sounds as if tasks are like boxes.
They can be.
You're surrounded with a different kind of hoarding that's going on. The hoarding of stuff.
That's a good thought. Yeah.
And I can see why you'd want to escape, because you get out into the field, you can breathe, you can spread your arms out. I'm having to take deep breaths just feeling suffocated on your behalf.
Yeah, it can be. And
it's
actually
such a gift.
You know, and Michael and I have been doing so much deep process work lately, and also a lot of things will pop up, you know, that maybe I've been very successful in keeping down for a while, you know, but because when you get to a new energy, a new vitality, then you're able to look at the next level of whatever. And so, you know, it pops up and it's like there in your face. And you know, like the other day I said it was my T-Rex came out, because when the fearful me is not succeeding in getting something done or achieved or whatever, then it's like the T-Rex comes out to protect the fearful me. It's like, ah.
Yeah. Right.
But,
so, oh it, my goodness. You didn't mention that.
And I've made a note. I'm going to do some work on that, that I have a different kind of hoarding, and that is of tasks. Thank you.
Yeah, and the tricky part of that is that you have a huge gift. And so it seems as if you need to use it, and you can use it. And so who gets sacrificed? The little stick figure gets lost again.
Right.
So, and what would happen? What would happen if you stopped typing and stopped posting and stopped putting up links and stopped cleaning? And I mean, can you imagine it?
Yeah. It's, you know, and there, we actually ran into something like that the other day. I was actually, believe it or not, in this living room, I have got three computers going right now, and I usually have the app stuff and the people from India going on one. I have the website and the lady who hosts their website. She's been helping me tremendously. And so I've got that on another one. And then I've got, you know, like I need to file some stuff for Dad for insurance and stuff like that. And I looked on his computer and couldn't find it, and I realized that that stuff was on Mom's old computer, so I had to dig it back out. So I've got it hooked back up so I can pull some files off of it. And, you know, so I bounce from one computer to the other. And then something was going on with Dad. I think that was the day that the occupational therapist had said, you know, they weren't going to come back unless, you know, they could prove that he was on some kind of meds or something that would improve his cognitive level. And anyway, and bless his heart, Michael came in and asked me about another project, and I just was like, I can't do it. You got to get somebody else to do it. I can't do it. I mean, it was like I cut him off immediately because it was like I was at the breaking point. And
yeah,
that wasn't fair to him.
Oh, well, you know, there's that story about the frog who's put in a warm pot of water, and they heat the water up and heat the water up, and the frog doesn't know that the water is heating up
until
the frog
dies.
Completely
cooked.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Like. And
yeah,
the compulsion, I think about my grandson, who is extremely bright and gifted like you. He can do so much, but he has these obsessive ritualistic thoughts. They're very different from what you're doing, so I don't need to go into it, but
I understand totally, though. It's the thoughts can be, I mean, that's one of the first triggers, and the thoughts could actually sometimes go to the point of being like destructive thoughts, whether, you know, it's that something's going to happen to you or that something's going to happen to somebody else.
Right.
Or, you know, and those are beyond control, too. I mean, it's, you know, people that haven't experienced it could say, well, quit thinking that way. You know?
Yeah.
But,
right. His doctor has told us that when he starts, I'll give you a quick example of what he does. He had a professor a year ago who criticized him in class. He made a comment, answered a question, and the professor said, whoa, 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 what was that about? And that began a terrible OCD cycle to the point where he felt as if this, and he thought, this is the denial, he thought his professor did that to him. And it was so bad that the parents went to the headmaster and said, Charlie has this interchange with the professor, and we just want the professor to know that Charlie has this odd anxiety thing and I don't know what the professor's going to do, but just be gentle and conscious. Well, the professor, being, I think, on the spectrum himself, very bright, gifted, funny guy, started treating Charlie with a kind of deference that Charlie recognized immediately was special, that the other students weren't getting this treatment, and this made it even worse. Now, this year, he doesn't even have the professor, but what he says to me, there'll be a silence, and I'll know he's going into his OCD, and he'll say, Orb, if he stared at you for 10 seconds, would you be upset? And I originally said, of course not. I mean, I might be curious, why is he staring at me? Did I do something? But I wouldn't think about it that much. If he stared at you for 7 seconds, and he goes on like this, and he finds reasons to ask for reassurance from me, the doctor said this will never end. You have to tell him that you are not going to engage in any way with this thinking, and just let him be with his thinking, painful as it is. And that's as much as I understand, is that we are not supposed to reassure him in any way, but leave him to his painful thoughts. And I know he feels as if it's a matter of survival. Michael says that in the work.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's true for you. And yeah. I've, Jeannie, I can tell you, I have worried about you way before you started telling us about OCD. I thought, this woman has put herself under a tremendous amount of pressure and has taken on a tremendous amount of responsibility. And it's such a gift, and it's been such a help. So it's almost as if you're, are you still there, Jeannie? Because I'm getting.
I am. I'm just breathing.
Good. Okay, good. I mean, I don't understand this, but my overwhelming urge is to just want to protect you from something that is so close to you that it's right in, under your skin and inside you, and when you run outside, it comes with you. And right. I have a lot invested in this because I see my grandson suffering the same way, and it's just so hard to see.
Yeah. One of the things that, and, you know, his maybe he thinks started with the professor, but
yeah.
One of the things that I found, and part of this was through doing that worksheet, but having an awareness of the background of the issue.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I said with Mom, it's probably because she grew up in the Depression era and, you know, had so little.
Right.
With me, it started with the, you know, feeling closed in here, in the house and not having space, and I had terrible self appreciation, or even, you know, I didn't think I was pretty. I didn't think, you know, it was like I was another wave of emotion.
Right, and when you got a little of it, your dad said you were pitying her and took it away from you.
Right. And I was constantly competing with my older brother. And I said, mm-hmm. I would give anything for him to still be here to compete with. He's the one that died last year.
Oh, Jeannie.
But, you know, an awareness of what's behind it. Like in my case, you know, the internal chaos and the clutter just is a reflection. But so, you know, I'm sure that Charlie's issue didn't begin with that professor. But
he
could
definitely
have
not.
An awareness of where does it come from that, you know, mm-hmm. for me it was so that somebody would see me.
Yeah.
And sometimes OCD will even cause you or drive you to apologies, listeners, for such a broken voice. I hope you can hear me.
You're good, Jeannie.
So
sometimes it even drives you to do things that are not fun. Like, I'll give you a good example. You know, Ari always handled the kitchen and all of that at Heartland, but about the second or third year of Michael and I being married, and of course the first year, my very first intensive was the week after we got married. It actually started the week before we got married, because my needing to have everything done and have it right, and we get to Heartland like 5 days before the wedding and the roof isn't on the Heart Center. It's oh my God. my leaving issue came up big time right then, but it was like, oh man. But then about it was the second or third year in, Ari couldn't come. And so I jumped in and took over the kitchen and was in charge of ordering the food and fixing the meals, and I hated it. I mean, I did a good job. I mean, everybody said, you know, the food was great and all of that, and I did a really good job, but I did not like the task at all. And but I still did it to perfection. And, I, you know, sent love to the people and did it with love, you know. I mean, and that happened a couple of years. And then finally I said, Michael, I can't. I said, I don't enjoy doing the kitchen. I said, I do a good job with it, but it's not in my purpose. I said, it may support you in your purpose, but it's not part of mine. And I actually, that's probably the first time that I declined to do a task.
Yeah.
But it's this drive. People that have OCD, it's, you know, we need to be perfect. We need to have it just so that we will be approved of and acceptable.
Mm-hmm. And safe.
That's probably with your grandson, too.
Yeah. Well, he comes from a long line of men who have had depression and anxiety, and to do things to stay safe, but not necessarily that they love. And boy, you just talked about doing the kitchen stuff. So yeah, it didn't start with the professor, but it became very obvious, very blown into our line of vision. It was under expressed before that. But wow.
Is he able to recognize, you know, I wasn't at first. I mean, it would just be like it would creep up on me and just, you know, I'm now more able to be aware of, you know, my driving need to do something, and can kind of breathe and go do something else, you know, like, you know, if a room is extraordinarily cluttered, then close the door. Exercising. For me, it's running. I actually, you know, I used to go to the gym and would run, and then when COVID hit, and so now I've got a treadmill here in the house next to the desk. And so, you know, for me, running, and I know what it does physically, besides, you know, helping you stay fit, but it releases chemicals in your body. I think they're the ones called endorphins that bring on like a happiness or whatever. And so that's kind of a relief. So I don't know if Charlie has an outlet that he can do that, you know, something like that, that helps him to redirect his focus.
Yeah, he does, but you're more aware than he is. For instance, I'll say to him now, how's it going? And he knows that's not a question meaning let's engage in the OCD discussion, but how's it going? And he'll say, I'm struggling, but he won't talk about it. And he doesn't have, I mean, I did a worksheet with him a couple of years ago, but he's not applying himself the way I hope he'll learn to. It's just because he's young, I think. He doesn't have the perspective. He's just suffering with it, and it's hard to see. And so I'm doing what Michael, I do worksheets. I visualize him as whole and peaceful and joyful. I consign him to God every time I think about him and
right.
do my work. But I feel as if that's the only help, and it's a lot of help. Michael has said that over and over. The best thing you can do is be well yourself. I understand
right.
that. But, you know,
Is he one that, I know you talk about going on walks sometimes with grandson. Is he one of them that goes with you on a walk?
It's rare. Yeah, and often he won't go. It would be good. And he's on a baseball tournament team, and he's an ace pitcher, and they often put him in to pitch the whole game. And I ask him, how are you when you're up there? And he may say, I didn't enjoy myself because I was, he calls it gut-golding. His professor was called Mr. Gut-gold. He said I was gut-golding the whole time. So it even comes into his, when he should be distracted. And yet he
right.
seems to like being at school. Somehow being among friends, he's likable and has friends. He says, I suffer more at home. So
a support system is very crucial to an OCD.
Yeah.
And so if his friends are, even though you all would be probably the better spiritual and mental support, mm-hmm. for him right now, probably his peers, at least
yeah.
he's not withdrawing. And because we can get into that, and I say we. It can be a cycle
yeah.
of, you have these thoughts mm-hmm. and the worst is going to happen and you're fearful
yeah.
and then that creates anxiety and then that creates
mm-hmm.
depression and then you get worried
right.
about the depression and then the whole cycle starts all over again,
Yeah.
Right, it's so good. His best friend is on a medication for something. And I think he's suffering from some anxiety. And these boys are pretty close. And I've asked Charlie, have you talked to Sam about what goes on with you? I mean, I don't use him to answer your OCD questions, but does he know you struggle? And he said, yeah, he knows. And I don't use him for that, but he knows. And so that's good, too. And
yeah.
The support system. So, yeah. Well, it's wonderful that you have more of a perspective, but boy, it's like stepping into an undertow when you get.
And there's times. I mean, I even texted you one day, was it last week or week before? Because we had
yeah.
talked about depression before, and
yeah,
a lot of people think, well, Jeannie's married to the master here; she's got it all together. and I don't.
Right.
And he is
the
awesome support for me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
But it's there. It's not something it's not a past event for me. It's still present.
Yeah.
I'm more aware, and because I'm doing the work and breathing and, I'm able to move through it, I think. I know when I got into that depression
A couple weeks ago,
it was only seemed to last like a day or something.
Yeah,
it wasn't long. And there have been times in the past where, I can say it would be weeks.
Oh boy, that's so hard.
So even though it's still here, it's at a lesser, doesn't control me as much as it used to.
Mm-hmm.
One thing Dr. Tim says, which I find extremely helpful, is when you said you reach a point sometimes when a worksheet isn't effective. It just, you can't
yeah.
even use that. And he says,
right.
soften and allow and be gentle with yourself. I'm sure you know that, but
yeah,
I hope you really do that.
Well, like I said, a lot of times, Michael, I mean, he has actually physically come in and gotten me and said, come on, you're going in here. You're going to, take a soaking bath, for 30 minutes or get on the Avacyn or, so he has
mm-hmm.
actually physically made me stop whatever it is I'm doing and
yeah.
take an intermission,
You know, I am not very good at self-care.
Yeah. Right. I'm picturing you needing an assistant. You're an assistant, and you need an assistant for yourself.
And well, I see a light at the end of the tunnel here when this app gets finished. You know, it's and I actually have the last couple of weeks, Susan and I have been working on the website, and she'll point something out, and she'll say, do you want me to do that for you? And I'm like, yes, please. So I have, in the past would not have done that.
That's
so
good.
That's a progression, I guess, for me to allow somebody else to do something.
Yeah. The website's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's coming together really well. I got an email this morning that notifying me that there were like 10 links that were broken. I don't know how I went through and took care of all of those last week, so I don't know. But anyway, I'm glad that this new system at least alerts me before, you know, somebody is on the website and says, oh, I went to this link and it didn't work. You know, at least WordPress sends me an email and says, this link is broke or this needs to be fixed or whatever. So
nice.
That's a step in the right direction. Yeah. So, but.
So the one thing you didn't say about this present house is it is your childhood home.
We moved here just a couple weeks after I turned 11.
I see.
And, my dad was in service when I was born, and then we moved to Newport News, Virginia, and lived over on the east coast then of Virginia for the first 10 years, I guess, of my life, and then we moved here. And
what was that like?
Moving here?
No, the original house.
In Newport News?
Yeah. That's where you had your...
Yeah, that was, it also was just a three-bedroom. And my three brothers, my grandmother has always lived with us. She moved in when I was like 2 weeks old. It's my mom's mom.
Whoa.
And she and I shared a bedroom. I was the only girl. And mom and dad had their bedroom, and granny and I shared a bedroom. And then the three boys had a bedroom. And it was that way in Newport News. And then when we moved here, this house, it was the same. So, you know, seven of us. And it was just challenging. You know, I mean, it's
right. Was your mother hoarding in that first house?
You know, I'm sure she did. I don't have a whole lot of memories. I told Michael I don't remember hardly anything before 5 years old. And then there's very few memories. Even, you know, in Newport News, I can remember little bits and pieces about the house or the yard. Mostly it was the friends. You know, Newport News is like flat. I mean, there's like, when we moved here, I was scared that the car was going to flip over because of the hills.
Yeah,
but everything was flat, and it was like one person's yard just merged into the next person's yard. And everybody had three or four kids, so there was always like, there was enough kids in the neighborhood, we could have two ball teams. And, you know, so we played constantly, and, you know, when mom would come out and whistle, she could whistle so loud. And she would whistle, and we could hear it all over the neighborhood, and we knew that meant come home. And, you know, we rode bikes and stuff. So most of my memories before we moved here to Bristol were playing and being with the kids outside and stuff like that. And my two younger brothers were really young. I mean, they were only 3 and 5 when we moved here. So after we moved here, then all kinds of things happened. Okay, excuse me if this is TMI, too much information. But I started having my cycles when I was 11 years old. It was right after we moved here.
Yeah.
And then it was like all of my life changed after that.
It was just so much happened after we moved here. And I think part of it probably was when we moved and some of the stuff didn't get taken out of boxes and boxes got put in corners. And, you know, I think that was the beginning of it.
Right.
But
did you go outside a lot when you moved to the new house?
Not a whole lot. Actually, I can only think of there were two girls in the neighborhood that were my age or within a year of me anyway. And, you know, we hardly ever did anything. We might, you know, walk home from school. You know, the bus picked us up two blocks away. The bus wouldn't come up these hills. And so we had to walk down to where the bus stop was. And so, you know, we'd talk as we walked home. But as far as doing things, you know, we didn't really. I went to, my older brother played football, so when Dad would go to football games, I would go with him just to, you know, go. But then, you know, Dad would go to the farm every weekend, and he usually took the boys with him, but he wouldn't take me. I guess he didn't know how to handle a girl. And so I was left here with Mom and Granny, and, you know, Mom was usually, bless her heart, she's gone now too, but, you know, she was usually in a bad mood, and I'm sure I triggered her. She didn't know how to handle a girl either, especially one that was going through, you know, hitting her cycles and looking at boys. And I actually got married when I was 16 years old. And
yeah.
Later I asked Mom, you know, why did you ever sign for me to get married? Because if she had made me wait until after school, if I had waited until after I graduated, I would not have married him. And he was my physical abuser for 3 years.
Right, right.
And so it was like jumped, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to get out of this clutter and get away and have my own place. And then what did I do? I ran into, you know, someone who would, you know, beat me and rape me and abuse me and did drugs and everything else. But nobody in my family had ever gotten a divorce. So it was like, you know, for 3 years I stuck with it because it's like, you know, I can't be the first one in my family to ever do that. That's like a cardinal sin.
Right. But, tremendous pressure.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so then it was always, you know, I got to keep ahead of things to stay safe. And
right.
So it just took on the OCD of needing to clean and pick up and straighten up. Just kind of carried over into a different kind of obsessive behavior.
Right. So you said in order to stay safe.
Yeah.
What would happen?
What's
unsafe about?
After I got married, if I didn't do or act or be exactly what he expected me to be, then I suffered the consequences physically.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I told Michael, I said, you know, one of the worst things is that I gave him one thing that I could never give anybody else, and that was my virginity.
Right.
And it didn't mean diddly squat to him. And it was just from there out, just such physical abuse. And, you know, I was still going to school. I completed high school on honor roll. I think I was 20 out of 200 and some kids.
Wow.
And, you know, just stayed on top of it. But then another thing was that he had to sign my report card, as crazy as that is. And
oh my goodness.
He wouldn't sign it unless I did certain things. And
oh, geez.
You know, it was just another lifetime. And so just, you know, you learn how to walk on the eggshells and do a certain behavior to be accepted, to stay safe. And And then that just kind of rolls over into every other activity. You know, I need to do this just perfect, and I need to do whatever. So OCD does impact almost every area of your life.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I do worksheets, and I know, you know, that our emotions and our feelings are based on our thoughts. And some of those thoughts have roots that go so deep, it's hard to pull them suckers out, you know?
Right. You don't even know what the thought is. That's been my experience with anxiety, is I will feel the swoon of the dark cloud coming through. And I'll think, this is a thought down there somewhere, but I'm not aware of any thought. I'm aware of imminent danger and doom. And then I can sort of backpedal into the worksheet and somehow figure out, maybe only partially, but it's been a kind of a back and forth thing. And the middle part of the worksheet has been most healing in that way, because it makes you stop and ask God to be shown another way. And then with Tim Hayes's patter, you know, remember a time when you were at peace. And Michael's question, how did it feel when your power person did that, is part of my forgiveness patter now too, because usually it's traceable back to some of those things. But yeah, what you say about finding the original thought, I don't even know if there is one, because it may be generational. And Michael, thank God, he has said, you don't really have to know. You just have to clear, forgive, and keep doing the work. But
one of the things that, and I don't know if this would help, one of the things that kind of triggered a beginning of, like you called, backpedaling, a lot of times it would be like, you know, we'd be eating dinner or something, and Michael would look at me and he'd go, you know, penny for your thoughts. And I'd look at him and I'd go, there were no thoughts. You know, and he said, well, where did you just go? And what we started paying attention to then was, you know, what I did to survive the abuse was basically to disassociate. Now, that's different from Michael talks about dissociating, but I would actually, like, leave my body so that I didn't feel the full impact of the abuse. And so when things would happen that Michael saw that I had, like, kind of left the room, even though I was still sitting there, is to, instead of necessarily trying to grab the thought, which often, like you just said, there isn't one, is to say, okay, what just happened in the room? And look at your space. You know, did the lights just change, or did a certain person walk in, or, you know, if you're in a restaurant, the build of a person that just went past you, or did they just dim the lights, or did a certain music come on, or, you know, and kind of look at the environment and say, what just happened that triggered my dissociation? Because, or disassociation, because it's like file folders linked together that, you know, an event happens, and you feel this emotion or feeling, and you leave your body. And so then those are all linked together. And so then it just takes triggering one of those file folders for all of it to come into view. And, you know, the dissociation, the leaving, is one of the first things then that triggers it. Okay, something just happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then kind of back into it and say, okay, you know, what just happened in the environment that would trigger me to leave? You know, or was there
really
a topic that was just being discussed, or, you know, what was the mood or whatever just prior to me disappearing? And of course, that helps having someone there that's aware enough to recognize, you know, oh, you just left the room. You know, even though you're still sitting here, you're not here. And then to be able to support you.
And you, when he asks that question, you're okay with it, or are you triggered to anger or any kind of reaction?
I think that, you know, maybe at first there were times when it would be like, I think the desire to avoid it. So it would be like, oh, nothing, you know, or whatever.
Right.
And to kind of slough it off. But then the more and more that we've done work around it and everything and are aware that, you know, like some of the issues around the abuse and everything come up when we're doing the breath work and stuff, or my hips will start hurting, or, you know, just different things that will trigger, or my neck or something, and it will, you know, kind of, it's like the body remembers, even if we are able to block it out of our mind and say, you know, I'm going to push that aside and not think about it anymore, the body still remembers, and so it sometimes will automatically react. And so it's just becoming more aware of, okay, let's dig into this, because you can't ignore it. It's in there. You can say, you know, you're not going to go there or look at it or whatever, but it's going to show up somehow or other in your life. And usually it's physical. So.
Wow, that's so interesting. Wow.
So thank you for this. You have opened an awesome one for me to look at, because, you know, we kind of half joking about it sometimes. You know, we know that it's a real thing for me. And Michael say, well, it's OCB. It's a blessing. You know, she gets things done and, you know, whatever. But it's still, it's a controlling issue. And, you know, you can cancel goals, and but there's deeper and deeper levels of it. So you face one level, and then, you know, the next thing you know, the next level comes up. But it doesn't come up until you're vital enough to look at it. You know, we have that automatic suppression that, you know, it won't let you see something that's going to literally kill you if it pops up in your face. And so I can see myself progressing, but it's still very present.
Is there any particular trigger? Like, I'll give you an example from my life. If I bump into something, or somebody comes in a room and sneaks up on me and startles me, my first reaction is rage. And, you know, when we were hit as little kids, that was a violation of my personal space, and it also hurt. So once I understood that I'm reacting to a visceral, physical memory, it isn't even in my thoughts, it's a physical reaction. I, like yesterday, I banged my head on the medicine cabinet door, which was open.
Ouch.
And I stepped back, and I was invited to feel rage, but I just saw the urge. I didn't act on it. You know, I might have wanted to pull the door off of the medicine cabinet or smash it or something.
Right.
Which is the power person doing the very thing you hated the most. Hit.
Right.
Hit
right.
back. Hit. And so I wondered if there's any kind of trigger for you that's similar.
Probably the, you know, the biggest thing is when I'm in this, like, forward motion. Let's say that, you know, I'm in the middle of a task and I need to get this done, and I'm focused there, and something happens to pull me away from it, and I know I'm not going to get that finished. I need to go over here and do this other. And so the actual priorities of my space overrules the priority in my head.
Right.
If that makes sense.
It does.
And then it's like, oh, I'm not going to get this done. And then, you know, if when I'm in that, and bless his heart, it's Michael now, comes in and says something or does something, and it's like this, I can't take one more thing, but I don't say that out loud, then I have a tendency to get defensive or you know, whatever. And then if that triggers him, if he comes back with what I would perceive as a strong voice or whatever back at me, then it's like my T-Rex comes out at that point.
Okay, right. Very understandable. Holy mackerel. Yeah, and Michael is under a lot of pressure, too. I hear him say, Jeannie, did you get that? Could you send out a link? Could you put this up on the thing? And I'm thinking, he also sounds as if there's a certain amount of pressure. I mean, when you have the goal of reaching every heart and mind and being on the planet, you've got a big goal
right
there. And he's got a lot of assistance now in the work of people who are doing similar work, like this Diedrich Wolfack
yeah
that Tim Hayes just talked about. My God, the synchronicity is mind-blowing. And
yeah,
I think
of that there's more and more.
Yeah. And I was, you know, Michael's work is the work, to me, the worksheet is it. And I have had
right
people who have come on the radio show and said, oh, this isn't the way I need to work, or this isn't for me, or whatever. And I understand that. I've tried many modalities, and I've stuck with this one because it really, really works. Works for me,
right,
and it would work for a lot of people, but it is, you know, it's a matter of personal preference and comfort and all kinds of weird stuff. But what Michael is doing will reach every heart, mind, and being on the planet, but he doesn't have to do it. He
right
is doing what he's doing, and I sometimes have to do deep breathing on for him too, because I'm thinking, oh my God, you're not responsible for all that. You're doing it. Look at Jesus. He had a little pile of followers. That's it. He had a little pile
yep
of people.
Yep. So, and we are thankful that you are on our team. I mean, you are such
oh
support. You know, you're calling in and talking with us on the show, the emails you send us, the support you send us. I mean, it's just, it's awesome, and we thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I feel as if it's the best deal in town. You have kept me from going totally bonkers during the pandemic. To be able to look forward to a siesta time in the middle of the day, settle in and hear these principles put forth with familiar, loving people who I totally trust, which is new for me, Jeannie. It's just
yeah
amazing. So
yeah
anyway, I can't thank you guys enough.
Yeah. Well, we've just got a couple minutes left, but did we cover everything you wanted to talk about, or is there anything else that we can quickly hit
oh
on?
Oh, no, this was wonderful. With Charlie, it's the more I learn, I may be sharing an email or an idea with you, but you're so far ahead of where he is in your understanding and ability to apply what you know. It isn't that you're not suffering gangbusters when it hits, but you've shortened the process. You do the stuff.
Right.
It's different. He isn't there yet, but it's wonderful to know that a person can get there, and it doesn't have to be a lifelong sentence.
Right.
Which it,
and
he
just,
feels as if
you know,
it is.
Sometimes just knowing, you know, okay, I'm not the only one that's in this spot, and, you know, they're getting through it. I can get through it. And it's
mm-hmm
not looking for a completion. You know, I don't look for OCD to go away, but I look
yeah
for it just to, you know, it can be a guidance instead of a
mm-hmm
hindrance. You know, it can
right
lead us to, you know, okay, why do I have this? There's a reason that
mm-hmm
I have this, and utilizing it for that instead of succumbing to it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. Jeannie, this has been great. Thank you so much.
It's been great for me. Thank you.
Good.
And we're
nice
down to the last minute. So
okay
thank you again. Feel free to write me again.
You're welcome. All right.
Okay,
great,
sweetie.
Jeannie.
Appreciate
thanks
you.
Yep.
Cherish you.
You
uh-huh so thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we hope that you have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world, and you deserve it.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness,